From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, UW-Milwaukee professor David Pate talks about the symbolism of a noose after several were found hanging in a Milwaukee park. Then we're joined by the director and a subject of the new documentary Unsettled, which explores the experiences of LGBTQ asylum seekers.
When they hear of refugees or asylum seekers from Africa, they think poor, uneducated, bedraggled. But in fact, Shina Marie had to give up a lot to come to the U.S.
Plus, gardening expert Melinda Myers explains how deadheading plants can help brighten up your garden.
Removing the faded flowers encourages more blooms. And so as much as it may pain you to get out there and clip off those flowers as they fade, think of it as a way of making sure you have more blossoms and color in your garden as you go.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. While demonstrations and conversations about racial justice continue around the country, several nooses were found hanging in a tree in Riverside Park. The nooses had pictures of Michael Brown, Trayvon Martin, Breonna Taylor, Eric Garner, and others who've died at the hands of police. The pictures were laminated and included the birth and death dates of each person. The Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office launched an investigation, and on Friday they identified the man who hung the nooses as a black man from Milwaukee. He told investigators he wanted to start a dialogue and teach his son a lesson about lynchings. The sheriff called it, quote, misguided, and said meaningful dialogue should be started in a more, quote, thoughtful and sensitive manner. UW-Milwaukee Associate Professor David Pate says a noose comes with a painful history. He spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, about the symbolism a noose holds.
The symbol of the noose is purely and simply a symbol of hate. It's a symbol for fear. It's a symbol for you should know your place. It's been that symbol since the Reconstruction era when people were very much feeling somewhat uncomfortable with the fact that Blacks were now free and able to make their own decisions. And as some would view as being uppity, you know, trying to show that they are equal to the person who has in previous times treated them as slaves. So with this particular incident, I do not view it as any form other than hate and a way to feel, let you know that there are still those of us who are in power, that being those who are white. And I think that's unfortunate, you know, particularly right now, people are somewhat uncomfortable with this discussion around race and in a revealing or unveiling or uncovering of what has been systemic racism and systemic and institutionalized practices of discrimination and oppression. And some people are very uncomfortable with that being highlighted. And also there's a lot of ignorance around what does that really mean to be part of a system that has purposely held down a group of people, particularly those who are Black.
I'm glad you initially got to the history of what a noose stands for, because believe it or not, like, there are people asking, what is the big deal, right? Debating the size of a noose as if the bigger or smaller it is that determines the threat level.
Yeah, you know, that's unfortunate because the noose has always been a symbol for those who are Black, and you just have to, a Black person knows this is, I'm telling you, you should know your place. If there was a noose anywhere within your vicinity, of your eyesight, unfortunately, a lot of this is, many people thought that lynchings were primarily in the South, but lynchings occurred in a variety of ways all over this country. And our most recent lynching was witnessing George Floyd being purposely killed by someone with their knee on their neck. That's a form of lynching. When you show I have power over you and I will apply pressure and I will decide whether you are my equal or not, and therefore I can kill you and get away with it. And that's what lynchings allowed. There was many an event. There were picnics and big gatherings to view a lynching of a Black man or a Black woman. We generally don't talk about the gendered part of this subject, but Black women were lynched as well for speaking out or showing their independence or doing something they weren't supposed to do, however that was. But again, this has been historically a symbol of hate and a symbol of fear. and retaliation in a way to show that we're going to do something if you don't do what we tell you. They being those in the majority.
Mm-hmm. And something else interesting that I've just noticed on social media, particular to this situation, is folks are trying to figure out if it was intended to scare Black folks, if it was hate at the root of it. But then there's also a couple folks who are like, this could be just a way to say, to bring attention to the way that these Black folks were murdered. It was like, mm-hmm. in some form, these their murders were lynchings.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question you present there. And it's very much in line with the whole idea of colorblind. Oh, we all are the same, and we just need to, and I want to show you that this is a way of understanding that this was bad. This, and the issue with colorblindness is that colorblindness only perpetuates injustice. And unless this country comes to terms with the idea that 400 years ago, now 401 years ago, people were bought as enslaved people to produce and develop the democracy that we currently exist, to develop the country that we currently have, to allow one particular group in particular, that being those who are white, the opportunity to flourish and gain economic security. It's ignorance if you think it's that. I would challenge anyone that unless you know American history, the noose is part of American history, a post-Reconstruction that was purposely done and used to say that I have my rope on your neck and I will kill you if I think that you are not abiding by the rules as I think they should be for a country that I have colonialized for my purpose. It can't be anything but a symbol of hate, particularly when it's directed at Black people. That's all it can be. And if someone Black did this, they have a problem and they don't understand their history of what a noose symbolizes.
I get where, you know, your position is this incident, the noose itself, it's nothing other than based in hate, telling yes. Black people they need to know their place. But yeah. With that being said, though, are you aware of like any other times in history, like up until this point, where symbols that were erected in hate and based in hate, have they been changed over time to have a different kind of message?
You know, when you direct any type of message towards a certain marginalized group, it's to minimize their citizenship, it's to minimize their humanity. I mean, there's been salt and pepper shakers of Black people. There's been jockeys on lawns to symbolize a Black person's servitude. There's been a variety of symbols that have always been developed with the purpose of marginalizing that person's humanity and their personage. There is no symbols I'm aware of that have been used in a way that you can now say, this is a symbol we've embraced. That's just, I'm not aware of anything like that. And as a result, my authority, or the reason I'm able to feel that with confidence, is I teach a class on Black Lives Matter at the university. And we study the history of what does it mean to be defined as a Black person, which is a sociological term. This Blackness is something that was created when people came over on the ships from Africa. It's as the 1619 story is told. And that's when people who were in the majority decided that they are different than us, they are less than us, and they're not human. So there's no symbols that I've ever seen that is associated with any marginalized group that is seen as a acceptable symbol, except by those who are in the majority. They may see it as a symbol that's okay, but unless there's someone who walks in the shoes of that person who is a marginalized person, it's hard to see that as a change.
Another thing just related to lynchings that like always just rubs me the wrong way is when the word itself is just thrown out when anybody feels like they're being threatened. Mm-hmm. And not really acknowledging the meaning behind that word. I mean,
of course, yes.
I think it was President Trump, when his impeachment inquiry was around, he called it a lynching. And I've heard other politicians use the word. So I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about just how folks use lynching, the word lynching in general?
You know, it's the sad part is that as Americans, we need to take a more critical analysis of how we use terms, because words mean something. And often people use those words to when it's going to benefit them. And in more recent times, when people have used the word, a word like lynching, they have no historical understanding of what a lynching is and who received the unfortunate result of what a lynching was. I mean, they need to go to the National Museum, the National Liberty Museum for Peace and Justice in Birmingham. Now, of course, people go there. They don't embrace the history. They just go there because it's a good photo op. But there's no excuse for ignorance when there's millions of books and there's Google. There's a lot of ways to learn about what is America and what this terminology means. And it is unfortunate because people are allowed to do this and we don't challenge them on it. I think that I would challenge the media to be more responsive to someone when they say that. I would challenge my colleagues in the university and in the academy to be more proactive about calling people out when they use the terminology wrong. And unfortunately, sometimes we're just too afraid to do that. We may lose some capitalistic gains if we do that, or friends. But I think we're in a position in our country right now where we just have to start telling the truth, and we have to be willing to speak the truth about what does it mean to be someone who is Black, Indigenous, and a person of color.
So to get back to the Riverside Park incident, mm-hmm. What are the conversations? What do we need to be doing that's different from before, that this type of incident doesn't happen again, that people get it? What needs to be done?
Well, I don't have the panacea as how do we solve this issue. I do think that what you're doing right here, for example, news stations like yourself, of course, this is a timely story, so you should have a discussion on it. But there also needs to be more organized public opportunities to talk about examine what are some of the historical policies that have been in place that have not allowed Black people to move further, but also to have people acknowledge what is the history of America? Because we tend to say that's Black history and this is white, this is American history. Black history is American history. And until people know just what's the foundation of this country and how this country was built and what have people who were here done to certain peoples, from those who are indigenous by stealing their land and to those who are Black and African by enslaving them and seeing them as chattel, and to those who are seen as Latino and Latinx and taking their labor, and those who are seen as Asian or Chinese and putting them in internment camps for their labor. Until people all know that as well as I do, we're not going to move any further. So there needs to be some place where those who are in positions of government, who have power, who are going to say, we're going to, for example, a big issue right now is to take police out of schools. Do not have the security. And Milwaukee has made a position of that. Milwaukee has decided that racism is a public health issue. I think those are big steps. It may not have been a lot of progress on that, but someone is making big steps to say, we are hearing what you are saying. We are doing something to make this a place where you see that you are equal and that your humanity is valued. I think we also need to do more around requiring schools, grade schools, middle schools, and high schools to talk about what the history of our country. I said that earlier, but I think that if we just start talking about what the reality is, people who are behind us who are younger hopefully will start passing this information on to their families and understand, in order for us to have an equal country, the reality is we're going to have to give up something that we have right now to someone who doesn't have it. You can't have everything you have right now. But that's a lot of conversation and a lot of strategic planning and a commitment by those who have power. And that's not me. That's people who I have to admit are white men in particular, who are willing to say, I need to give up some of what I have in order for others to be on the same plane, to be in the same playing field I am, to reduce some of the issues that we all confront. You know, poverty is not something we all want to use to pay for our taxes necessarily. But when one person does better, or when all of us do better, then we're going to all be better off. And until we admit that there's some of us who could be better off, and we just decide their kids need better schools. They need a safer environment. And it's not that the people there just don't know they want that. It's that they have to be given the opportunity to have that. So that's not the magical answer, but it's a number of strategies that should be implemented that one require more talking and one require people to be very honest about what they're hearing and what they're saying.
David Pate is the chair and associate professor for the Department of Social Work at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare. He spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell. Coming up next, we speak with the director and a subject of the new documentary, Unsettled. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. As we celebrate Pride this month, we look back on all of the accomplishments and progress the LGBTQ community has made. Most recently, a Supreme Court decision that bans LGBT employment discrimination. However, in 70 countries, it is still illegal to be gay, lesbian, or transgender. In 4, the punishment is death. These hostile environments are life-threatening, leaving some with no choice but to escape and seek new life in other countries to face entirely new challenges. A new documentary called Unsettled follows several LGBTQ refugees and asylum seekers from Africa and the Middle East as they leave their home countries for safety in the United States, a country that continues to demonize immigrants and drastically restrict admittance of refugees and asylum seekers. The film is directed by Tom Shepard and features Cheyenne's story, who fled Angola with her now wife Marie after facing brutal harassment from their community. They both join me now, and Tom begins by explaining how he was able to find subjects willing to share their intense journeys.
In, I think it was 2014, I started volunteering at a refugee resettlement organization in the Bay Area. It's called Jewish Family and Community Services of the East Bay. And I had proposed to them some months before the possibility of doing a documentary. And they were, you know, very nice about it, but they were like, absolutely not. You know, the folks that we see, our clients, when they get here, most of them have experienced trauma, if not torture. And so, you know, to put cameras in front of people's faces, especially at such a vulnerable time, is, you know, we just feel like we can't do that. And so, but they said we really could use some volunteers. And in this new program, they had gotten money from the State Department to resettle queer refugees. And that was the first time in the United States a concerted effort had been made to do that. And so for several months, I was able to just meet folks, listen, watch. And I think they saw too that I was interested in not just, you know, swooping in and telling a story, but being around for months, if not years, and getting to know people and building trust. So that's when I met Subi, who is from Syria, and Junior, who's from the Congo. But I'd met a woman, her name is Melanie Nathan, who is a refugee rights advocate in the Bay Area. And I know she had been following Cheyenne Marie's story in Luanda, Angola, and she knew that I was starting this project. And so she said, you know, you have to meet these two women. They're the most charming, talented, incredible story of a relationship that had formed. And she had found out that they'd gotten student visas and that they were coming to the US. And so that's how I got the chance to meet Cheyenne and Marie.
And Cheyenne, what were your initial thoughts about the project and why did you and Marie want to be involved?
Well, it wasn't that easy at the beginning. Of course, we barely knew Tom. And that idea was a little bit, let's say, scary because we didn't know exactly the intentions coming from Tom, like why exactly you wanted to do the film, why exactly you want us in the film. And also we had to be conscious that, you know, our families in the future would watch the film. So we also didn't want to put their lives in danger in any way. So it took time to kind of gain trust to Tom, but we were able to build that like from time. And so the reason why we accepted to be in a film is that we saw that we could actually help educate people, right, society, because a lot of people have no idea the difference between refugees and asylum seekers, first of all. And there's still that stigma that refugees or asylum seekers or immigrants come to United States to steal American jobs or like take something away from them. And we are just here like occupying a space. So we kind of wanted also to show the struggles that we actually go through, the ups and downs, just to get legalized, you know, to get your life together. Because this is really what we were here for, like to kind of build a dignified life, you know, not being persecuted. And it's true, we could definitely like choose go to Europe, but for some people, United States, it's like a step ahead to what they are looking for. And we were looking for peace. So we chose United States as an escape.
So yeah, let's get into that a little bit. And you mentioned it's hard to build trust because you left a very fraught situation in your home country and were just trying to establish your own lives here. So for our audience, can you explain why you left Angola and came to the United States to seek asylum?
Sure. So Maddie and I are a couple, and we individually were persecuted, right, for being gay, mostly Maddie, because like, if you look at Maddie, there's no way you can deny that she's lesbian. Now, in my case, that was like that, you couldn't really tell because I was too femme, let's say like that. So I could hide a little bit and kind of put myself in the box without people noticing. And when we actually became a couple, like officially, like, of course, we could even tell people, lie to them and tell, no, we're just sisters or we are cousins, but it was very obvious. And the persecution just started like getting worse from time, like at the point that our lives were like in danger. So that's when we had to find a way to escape. We did go to Cape Town, South Africa first. And we were trying to get asylum over there. However, the office closed and we couldn't get the papers from there. So we had to go back to Angola and then try and find another way, like as quick as possible to escape. So that's when we like escaped to the United States as a student.
With your lives in danger, many people, as you mentioned on the American front, stigmatize immigrants, refugees. But there are big costs. So what are the costs persecuted immigrants pay for seeking refuge? And how are everyday Americans stepping forward and helping those most in need?
Sure. Well, you know, back in 2014, if you looked around and as Cheyenne said, if you talked to most people in the queer community, they couldn't tell you much about refugees. And at that time, you know, LGBT civil rights was sort of accelerating. The marriage equality was steamrolling toward the Supreme Court at that point. But if you looked at places like Angola or Syria, other parts of the world, it seems like the persecution was getting worse. And so I think the question is, who was gonna step forward? And aside from Jewish Family and Community Services and some of the other refugee groups there, you know, refugee resettlement in the US is very much modeled on families. So a family will flee a war-torn region, say they come from Iraq, and if they come to the Bay Area where I live, they'll immediately get connected to, you know, a mosque or a community group or, you know, with other people from their country, from their diaspora. But if you're like a gay Iraqi guy and you come to the Bay Area, you know, it's possible that the last people you might want to see are other Iraqis because you are fearful that you're going to face the same hatred or harassment that you did back home. And so what we were finding as we were making the film is that LGBTQ refugees and asylum seekers are at much higher risk for isolation and also depression and PTSD. And, you know, if these groups are not in place, who is going to help people? And so it was great in our film that we were able to kind of film volunteers like Galen Workman, who was with the Unitarian Church, Melanie, Fred Hertz, who was part of Jewish Family and Community Services. Most of those folks are LGBT themselves, and they understood what these risks were, and they stepped forward and volunteered their homes or, you know, time to spend with folks or, you know, donations to help these folks survive. I mean, the other thing about Cheyenne and Marie as asylum seekers is they don't get any benefits when they come, and they have to themselves find an attorney who's going to represent them, either pay to you know, hire an attorney or get a pro bono attorney who can, you know, adjudicate their case in the immigration courts. Well, that takes a long time. How are you going to support yourselves over the course of, I don't know how long it was, Cheyenne, maybe 2 or 3 years that you
guys— I think it was 3 years, and we had to work under the table, which was super dangerous because if we were caught, like, we would lose everything, like any chance to stay in the United States. But again, we definitely had to find a way to pay bills, right, and sustain ourselves.
You mentioned you had tried to seek asylum in Cape Town, South Africa before coming to the United States, but did you and Marie expect the adjudication process to take 3 years? What were your expectations with the United States in seeking asylum here?
Well, the expectation wasn't, it was like 50-50, right? First of all, because we didn't have a lot of information about the process before we came to the United States. And we were kind of learning that, like, when we were like applying for it and all of that. So we were understandable that there were more people in front of us, like it was a waiting list. So, and they were going by months. So like the year that you came to the United States to be able to get your paperwork. But, we didn't have much expectations, honestly. We were just hoping for the best.
Yeah, Cheyenne, I admired both you and Marie's resiliency throughout this whole process. So what was it like for you both to recount your experience countless times? And you had each other, of course, to support each other, but it's a taxing experience that few of us can only imagine.
Yeah, no, it's very depressing to have to go through everything all over again, like from the beginning. And it's very traumatizing. Like you will spend like a whole week just depressed and like in bed. So it was very, very hard. And also when we got into the office, we had to be like sort of separated. Marty had to go in and tell the story. And then I had to go in myself. So we were not given the opportunity to actually stay in the same room at the same time to tell the story, which is even harder, right? Because you don't have like your support there. And there are things that you forget and you're like fearful that if you forget something, they might use it against you. Okay, no, we don't see you compatible. You're not gonna get like the asylum seeker. So it's very, so like, it's exhausting. It's very exhausting to have to go through it. I mean, we have gotten better. We can't now like talk about it, even though we prefer not, because there are things we just don't want to remember. But it was very hard, like having to, like you telling your story, which is a true story. However, the person on the other end might see him in a different way. So there is that.
In the introduction of the documentary, Cheyenne, you said that you have this anger in your heart, and that's in regard to your experiences in Angola. Now that the documentary is made, and as you said, it's easier to talk about these things and it's a reflective experience, I'm wondering, what do you feel in your heart now that you are living a better and stable life in Nevada with your wife?
Well, I feel very at peace right now, honestly. I took this time to really work on myself, mentally and physically. And it takes time. It takes time. There are days that you're definitely going to fall into that rabbit hole again and get that depression. But I don't have any hate or anger in my heart, honestly. Like, people are really welcome in my circle, but we are just very careful now of who we let in, because we still have that kind of thing. Like, who can we really trust? But I'm very at peace now. I've worked on myself a lot. I am in contact with my parents as well, which it's like it has been a big change. And it's been great. It's been great. Life is always going to have its up and down, but I'm so glad that I am at the place where I am today.
Tom, what have been some of your, you know, positive and impactful outcomes from doing this documentary?
Well, you know, some of the most exciting moments were when Cheyenne and Marie and some of the other subjects of the film traveled. We traveled together to film festivals, and there's nothing like kind of seeing it on a big screen with a live audience. Of course, we're all missing that right now since early March, but fortunately we premiered the film at the San Francisco International Film Festival just over a year ago to two or three sold out screenings. And it's amazing. I think, you know, people are so drawn to all of the refugees and asylees in the film. And when they then see like Cheyenne and Marie come up on stage afterwards, you know, I mean, it was immediate standing ovation. And so I think there's an acknowledgement of the struggles that these folks went through, but this, as you said, this incredible resiliency. And, you know, just to point out too, like Cheyenne and Marie, when they were in Angola, they were quite successful, both as musicians and entertainers and dancers, but also they had their own business. So it wasn't like they were in this sort of destitute situation. I think a lot of Americans, when they hear of refugees or asylum seekers from Africa, they think poor, uneducated, bedraggled. But in fact, Cheyenne and Marie had to give up a lot to come to the US. So I think when audiences like understand that better and they see the film and the, you know, we hope that the film sort of humanizes these sort of lived experiences, they start to understand more, and it's really lovely. And we feel so lucky to be, we're gonna show the film on public television. It's gonna be on a show called Doc World on June 28th. And then it's gonna be streaming for free on pbs.org and worldchannel.org for a couple of weeks. So I can't wait to hear what people around the world think of the film. And I'm curious, Cheyenne, like, if, you know, maybe there's a chance that we could even like connect with your family afterwards. I certainly want to hear from you, like what their reactions are.
I know. I want to see what their reactions are first, for sure.
Well, it's definitely important to continue sharing this aspect of the immigrant and asylum seeker struggles. And Tom and Cheyenne, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me about Unsettled today. Truly, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure.
Tom Shepard is the director, and Cheyenne is one of the subjects of the new documentary, Unsettled, Seeking Refuge in America. The film premiered on Doc World on public television yesterday and is now available to stream for free on pbs.org and worldchannel.org until July 12th. Coming up, we learn about the importance of deadheading in your garden. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The summer is in full swing and gardens are looking green, but there's always ways to make our flower beds sparkle just a bit brighter. Every month, Lake Effect contributor Melinda Myers joins Joy Powers to give her expert tips on gardening. This month, she explains the process of deadheading flowers, how it works, and how it can help your garden.
As we know, it's June. A lot of us, our gardens are already in bloom. I think most of us are seeing a lot of greenery right now. But we're about to talk about a process that is in some ways removing that greenery to encourage more greenery. So explain to me, what is deadheading?
Deadheading is removing those faded flowers, and in some cases it's just so the plants look neat and tidy. In other cases, especially with annuals and some perennials, removing the faded flowers encourages more blooms. And so as much as it may pain you to get out there and clip off those flowers as they fade, think of it as a way of making sure you have more blossoms and color in your garden as you go. And one thing I like to do is pick a few flowers to enjoy indoors. So that's one way of picking them before they start to decline, and that's a way of removing those flowers so that you're encouraging more blooms, but you get to enjoy some inside as well. And I think it feels less painful harvesting than deadheading sometimes.
Yeah, how do you know if a plant actually needs to be deadheaded?
You know, a great question. Some plants like impatiens are self-cleaning, and you'll see that they drop their old petals and they just keep blooming and you don't need to do anything. Calibrachoas or million bells, they're like mini petunias. Those don't need deadheading. They keep blooming and going crazy all season. And so a lot of gardeners will look for those because they're lower maintenance. But then there are some of those like, say, your annual salvias or even your perennial salvias. As that flower fades, if you don't get more blooms producing, remove those faded flowers. Some things like snapdragons, they actually start forming seeds. Or lantana, you'll see little berries forming. And so they start putting all their energy into the seed pods or those little berries and produce very few flowers. So it's a good indication that, oops, I need to get out there and remove those stems with the seed pods or the little berries and then keep track of those plants a little better. So as the flowers fade, get out there before they start forming the seeds. So that's kind of a clue that it's something that needs your attention a little sooner rather than later.
Okay, so when a plant goes to seed like that, that's a good indication that you should deadhead. Is that true for most plants?
You know, that is a good plan unless you want those seeds. Sometimes gardeners at the end of the season will let their marigolds or zinnias form seeds and then they'll collect those and plant. But hybrids don't come true from seed, so just don't be surprised with what you turn up with. But that's part of the fun of gardening. So, you know, if your plants are fading and they're not producing more flowers, especially annuals, that's a good sign that you're seeing a need to get out there and remove them. Now, with perennials, a lot of them have a shorter bloom time. They typically don't bloom all summer long. So a lot of those we deadhead just for aesthetics, so it looks better. Some we can leave, especially towards the end of the season, so that we have seeds for the birds to eat, things like coneflowers. And some of them, like coneflowers, we may want to deadhead early to get more bloom, but then that last flush of flowers let them form the seeds so that we have winter interest and then food for the birds.
Now, is there a specific way that you should be doing this? You know, cutting at an angle, different ways to ensure that you're getting the most out of your plant?
You know, great question. And this is, again, we're looking at how the plant grows. So I think a lot of us know salvia or plants with spikes of flowers. And so how salvia blooms, it sends up a main flower stem and that main flower stem starts to fade. Now on the perennial, you're going to cut back to either side buds. You'll see new little flower buds forming or leaves. And so that's going to give a clean look. Then those side buds were going to grow into flowers. And by removing that first flower, that second flush of bloom is going to be that much more impressive. So things that have spikes, tall stems with little flowers on it, we're going to prune back to a set of healthy leaves. Or if you see branches or buds coming out the side, you'll prune back to there. Now, there are some things like daylilies or balloon flower where each individual flower fades. It only lasts a day, but there may be 30 on that flower stem. So I always put my daylilies back where the faded flowers don't bother me because it's going out every day and removing those. Some people say those faded flowers look like dirty handkerchiefs, so they can't stand it. And so going out every day and pulling off those faded flowers allows the remaining ones to grow, develop, and shine. And then you remove that whole flower stem when it's done. And that's mainly for aesthetics. That flower spike is going to continue to open flowers each day. And that's more of an aesthetic. Then something like hostas or coral bells have their flowers on a flower stem, and it comes right directly out of the ground. And those we're going to prune back right to the ground level, and that'll be out of sight because that's where the flowers originate. That's where we remove the faded flowers.
Now, I'm someone who does a lot of herb gardening, and something I've noticed this year, both with herbs that I started from seed and herbs that I bought at the store, is a lot of them are going to seed pretty quickly. They're already starting to flower. Is there any way to, you know, deadhead, I guess, one of those plants to encourage the rest to grow?
You know, great point. And I've noticed that on my basil too. I'm just amazed at how quickly they're going to flower. So some people call that live heading. So things like coleus or your herbs that are forming flowers, especially basil, we don't want them to flower. Instead, we want them to produce more leaves and stems. So we pinch off that flower as soon as we see that. So then it will produce more leaves and stems. You remove that pinching, removing that tip, removes a hormone that stimulates more growth, and that encourages, by removing that tip, it encourages some of the side buds to form new branches with leaves, so you'll have more to harvest. So as you know, as an herb grower, that you do regular harvest, you harvest when you need it, that encourages more growth. But when that plant sneaks in and starts blooming, you want to pinch that off. The flowers are edible on basil and some of the other herbs, but we really are looking for that flavor from the leaves. So live heading, removing those flowers before they fade, is a great way to take care of that problem.
Well, and how are these two things, deadheading, live heading, different from pinching and pruning in general? What's the difference, and when should you do that?
You know, pinching is just removing that growing tip, and that's where that auxin hormone is that encourages plants to grow upward instead of having branching and growing outward. So a lot of times when we put a young plant in the garden and it's kind of tall and leggy, we may just pinch out that growing tip to encourage branching. Now, sometimes we do a pruning or a hard pinch where we'll take our pruners and we'll actually cut halfway down the plant, or you know, a little bit further, and cut above a set of healthy leaves or where there were buds, because we want to encourage more compact growth as well as branching. And so we'll sometimes do that, like for some of our perennials. I'm bringing salvia up again because I think it's one so many people know. But with perennial salvia, after the second flush of bloom, sometimes those plants get floppy. And so we'll cut them back about halfway. That encourages new growth. Some varieties will flower again, but really what we're looking for is nice looking leaves for the rest of the season. And you can do that on leggy herbs as well. If your herbs have, you know, kind of gotten away from you and there's just one straggly stem, you may want to prune that back to encourage more branching, more compact growth, and more leaves and stems to harvest in the future.
So right now, a lot of our gardens, they have a lot of flowers. Things are looking great, but I know that there are other things that we can do to make sure that our plants continue to look great. What should you be doing right now here in June?
You know, a couple of things. If you haven't mulched the soil, mulching the soil with, say, shredded leaves, it seems like we always have those leaves that appear in our landscape. At least they always did when I lived in the city. For trees and shrubs, I don't mind using bark or twice or triple shredded bark on perennials. Evergreen needles, I'm a big believer in kind of putting to work whatever you have in your landscape. But mulching, spreading a thin layer of those shredded leaves or evergreen needles around on the soil around your plants helps conserve moisture, suppress weeds, because boy, the weeds are going great this year once again. And then it also, as they break down, they improve the soil. So mulching. If you fertilized at planting and used a slow-release fertilizer, you may be set for the season. If you haven't fertilized or your plants look like they need a bit of a nutrient boost, midsummer is a good time to use a low-nitrogen slow-release fertilizer. I think all your listeners know I'm a fan of Milorganite because it's goof-proof and won't burn your plants if you fertilize in the heat of summer. And it provides, any of those low-nitrogen, slow-release fertilizers are providing small bits of nutrients over a longer period of time. So it promotes equal above and below ground growth, slow, steady growth that's less susceptible to insects and disease, won't interfere with flowering, and is more drought tolerant. So a mid-season boost, nutrient boost if needed. And then I think watering is always the challenge for any gardener. You know, our weather is crazy, then the temperatures are really high like we've had recently. You may be watering more often. When things are cool, you water less often. So you always want to water thoroughly to encourage good deep roots. Check the soil, the top few inches. If they're crumbly and moist and slightly moist and starting to dry, it's time to water again. You know, if you wait till it's bone dry, your plants are probably going to suffer unless they're really drought tolerant established plants. Overwatering is just as bad as underwatering. and watering shallow every night really encourages shallow roots that once you leave town for a few days or forget to water for a couple days, those plants suffer. So a good soaking eventually once a week is usually enough for most plants in whatever is normal weather for us here in Wisconsin.
Yeah. All right. Well, Melinda Myers, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, thank you, and everybody, enjoy your gardens. We've got a beautiful summer ahead of us.
Melinda Myers is an expert in all things gardening and a regular Lake Effect contributor. She spoke with Joy Powers, and you can find more of their conversations about gardening at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break and then hear an essay that compares the coronavirus pandemic to experiences during the Great Depression. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The coronavirus pandemic is, in some ways, an echo of our history. People have compared it to other health crises, like the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic. Others have compared the economic downturn to what happened during the Great Depression. For essayist Aleta Chacik, these parallels were borne out in letters from her grandfather, a business owner who lived through the Depression. Her essay titled, We Have Managed So Far, begins with a passage from one of her grandfather's letters.
We have been having bad times here in America, but we have managed so far. There are 12 to 13 million good laborers unemployed. During the past years, the entire government has been badly governed. I think it will be a long time to get the country back on an even keel. The words jump off the page as I read the letter my grandfather wrote home to his brother in Norway in September of 1933. I'm struck by the parallel of his thoughts then with an America drowning in reports of how the COVID-19 pandemic is ravaging our healthcare system and our economic engines. I reread his letter with new eyes. Since Safer at Home was declared, I spend much of my time connecting with people I would ordinarily see when socializing, exercising, worshiping, and volunteering. My husband and I follow closely the well-being of our families who are working and going to school from home. Life goes on, and yet somehow we are mentally exhausted at the end of the day. Why is that? Is it the constant reports of numbers of confirmed cases and death from COVID-19? Is it the unending he said, she said from governmental leaders that wears me down? My heart breaks seeing images of exhausted and poorly equipped healthcare workers. But why is it so heavy for me? It's not my family. Maybe it's the woman I know whose husband died from COVID-19. Or the friends whose nurse daughter wears garbage bags taped together because her hospital has run out of gowns. Or the distraught church member's cries over a relative who has died without the comfort of family. Or the toddler grandson who cannot understand that the image of his birthday cake is too far away to actually eat. When my grandfather wrote, "We have managed so far," as he did frequently in his long letter, was he whistling in the dark or was he confident so far? My grandfather could recite the ways in which his world had changed, how much money and land he had lost. But he could also see he had a responsibility to use what resources he had well. He went on to write of the employee he will keep on as long as he can, of the support of his family here, of his concern for his distant family in Norway. He gave a local family with an unemployed dad $5 a week from his reduced earnings because he cannot, in his words, let them starve. Even though our world has shrunk to our homes and neighborhoods, we can both see and talk to people around the globe. But that does not mean we know how to cope with day-to-day challenges. What if we have no internet connection? How does our daughter work when the daycare is closed? When will I be able to see my doctor, get my teeth cleaned, my hair cut? How to manage seems to change daily. Sometimes the only answer is, we just don't know. As disrupted as our society is by slowing down, imposing limits on everyone, there is evidence that people are coming together to appreciate one another. We can't provide PPE to overtaxed healthcare workers, but we can cheer for them. We can donate to local food programs. We can appreciate our mail person, our sanitation workers. Most of all, we can stay at home and not become patients ourselves. Just as in the Great Depression, some people will get through this time and be stronger for it. Others will add burdens of unemployment, fractured relationships, diseases and death to already fragile lives and succumb to despair. Not everyone will survive. It is likely that without some dramatic societal intervention, those who entered this time with the fewest resources will pay the highest price. During the 1990s, a time when the future of my grandfather's business, started in 1931, was very much in doubt, my brother Mark became the owner-operator. Not only has he kept the business going, he has grown it to a chain of stores where many fourth-generation family members participate in its operations. Today, that business is being stressed once again. Like his grandfather before him, Mark does not know how this will end. Selling appliances is considered an essential service, but sales are way down. Contractors are not bidding. Inventory must be maintained, and employees paid, all while ongoing expenses continue. He has laid off only 10% of his employees for now. He is paying health insurance for his remaining employees. His resilience is being tested, but so far, he is managing. Where do we get hope in this uncertain time of COVID-19? Each of us must look for it in ourselves, our family, and our communities. For me, I leave you with Grandpa's words, written long ago. I think you are getting tired of reading about all this misery. I have to tell you, it is twice as bad as I'm able to describe it in a letter. But once again, I want to say, I haven't lost my spirit. There will surely be sunshine one day again. We are managing so far.
Aletta Chosik is an author living in Milwaukee, and you can find more of her work on WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.